Hi, this is a Life of Learning podcast. We hope you enjoy this episode.
Hi everyone, today we have Ben Cornish, who I met at the recent BJC in Ramsgate. Hi Ben, thanks for coming on to the podcast.
Hi Reggie, lovely to be here.
Brilliant. I mean, before we started the podcast, I mentioned that we had a conversation probably for about an hour at the BJC. And what I was thinking then was I was hoping that we could have actually recorded it. So really appreciate you coming on the show again. And hopefully we can get into some of those topics that we discussed back then.
Yeah. No, it's a pleasure. I mean, it's always difficult with things like that. You kind of wish you could maybe, you know, click on a button and those conversations that seemed to be really important at the time. I tend to write quite a lot of notes. So quite often I did actually write down, for example, who everyone was in the show and stuff like that, because I know that once you leave the environment, it's easy to forget what you saw or what you did. So I try to write a lot of things down, and, you know, things, conversations I've had, I try to kind of jot them down as well, just so they don't just drift off into nothingness, as it's so easy to do, you know.
Wow, you're a man after my own heart, because after every day at the juggling convention, I've journaled everything, because I just know that in a few days' time, I'm just going to forget. And I wrote down everything that I did. In fact, I've done it actually a podcast episode of of my time there as well. So, so because I just forget, and people do forget. I mean, if you ask someone what you did on the Thursday at the BJC, mind you, there was no Thursday at the BJC, but yeah, you wouldn't remember it unless you wrote it down.
Well, funnily enough, talking about journaling, I've just got this book here. Just before I came to the BJC, we went to Italy for a month, and that's my journal from there every day. And towards the end of our time, we were there for a month, I started reading my partner on the train. We'd been there for 3 weeks, and I was reading stuff from the first week to her. And she'd forgotten, you know, we'd forgotten about this happening or that happening. So, yeah, and I don't do it every day, but I do it if there's an event or there's something, you know, it feels like important to just remember what's going on.
Yeah. And it's funny, because even when you do that, it's not the big things you'd think you'd remember, but sometimes you even forget those.
No, you don't. I mean, it's interesting though, isn't it? Memory is a kind of tapestry of what's important to us at the time, what we make a point of remembering. And it's very easy to forget, even really, you know, even really important, seemingly important things, it's easy to forget.
Yeah, got it. Okay, Ben, let's start from the beginning. What got you into juggling? And yeah, it's got you into juggling.
Yeah, from the beginning. I mean, I was trying to think about this earlier on, because it happened in two or three phases for me, because it didn't happen in one go. It wasn't like, oh, juggling, wow, I've got to start doing that. That's amazing, you know, which I certainly know some people have had that experience. But there was a joke shop in Exeter, and I used to hang around in there quite a lot. It was run by a ruffian called Dick Gerrish, who was an extraordinary man, and cabaret shows and things like that. It's very funny, but I used to love the joke shop. It was just an interesting place to hang out long before juggling ever came. And I think he had three beanbags on his counter, and I think I was maybe 17 or 18 or something at the time. And I bought them, and just because I liked the look of them. And I think I just thought, oh, juggling, yeah, that's the thing, you know. And then just kept them on a shelf somewhere. That year, we went to America to see my sister, who was living in New York, and she had a friend. I mentioned juggling at some point, and this guy said, oh, come into the other room, and I'll show you how to do juggling. And I was like, oh, great. So he took me into this other room, and then he went 1, 2, 3, dropped them all on the floor, you know, just showing me how to kind of get rid of them all. And being an arrogant 18-year-old, I just kind of went, oh, that's not proper juggling, and just kind of dismissed it out of hand and didn't do it. Scroll forward several years, I'm at Dartington College of Arts doing a theatre degree, and I'm living with a guy, and I think we both talked about it at some point, and I said, I think it'd be good thing to learn juggling. I've got some beanbags. And we bought the book that was out, Juggling for the Complete Klutz, which had three square beanbags in a little drawstring or a little, you know, netting bag on the side of the book. So we got that. So we had my beanbags, we had these beanbags, and we had the book. And we just taught ourselves how to juggle. And then it just so happened that later on in or that term or that year at college, another guy came who could already do a bit of juggling and could do clubs. It was like, oh my God, clubs, you know. So we didn't know anything. It was just three beanbags, and that was it. We learned one night over about 8 hours to pass them to each other. We'd read about the timing, and we you know, we didn't know about good technique or how to look at each other or anything. It was literally just force of willpower kind of thing, you know. So, yeah, so there, it was a false start. And then I started, and then there was a project at college which encompassed juggling. So it also had juggling, tight ropes, you know, devil stick. We did a bit of everything kind of thing. And then a while later, juggling was the thing that stuck with me. It didn't at the time. I wasn't like, oh, juggling, this is the one. I actually liked tightrope walking, and I thought that was going to be my thing. But maybe I realised that how impractical tightrope walking was, and how you can't put a ring in your pocket or take it anywhere with you and practice. And that, in the end, was the deciding factor. Is you can have, here we go, you can have three balls anywhere you go, and you can just practice them whenever you like. It's free. It's cheap. It's whatever. And then I realised. I'd seen a couple more people, and you know, I could see there was a bit more to it. But also, while I was at Dartington, before I'd even started juggling, I had started developing an interest in street theatre, and I used to go and watch Covent Garden. And I was lucky. I think I saw it at a particularly good time. It was before there was a sort of board of people who would deem what was suitable and what wasn't. So it was still pretty anarchic then. But it seemed to me, what I realised, and my other great love is comedy. I've always been fascinated by comedy. I love comedy. I'm obsessed with Laurel and Hardy, and because they wrote the rules on comedy and all that stuff. And it seemed to me, when I was watching these, the funniest people doing the street performances were nearly always the jugglers. So I think I was just drawn to it subconsciously, I think, from that side of it. Oh, yeah, the funny ones, they're the jugglers. And somewhere in my head, that didn't spark a light. But I think later on, I realised that was maybe what was driving that decision. You could do comedy as well as presenting a skill. Yeah.
Okay. Wow. Okay. So, okay, can we just move on to the comedy element and the performing? So, would you say from then on, your love of juggling came from looking at the street performers and then trying to tie in comedy with the juggling? And then, did you try and develop your own sort of like routine then?
Well, no, I didn't have any ideas about that at all at the time.
Okay. Because
my first juggling performing was done within a group. It was in a story context, and I was a character who was a juggler, happened to be a sort of evil character, and I'd learned to fire juggle by that time. So I had a little routine with balls, and then I had a little fire routine that I could do with clubs. And also somebody had got me into a piece that they were doing at college, and I became a juggling cephologist. Oh. Do you know what a cephologist is?
No, I don't.
So the guy on Newsnight, when it comes to doing the elections, it used to have a swingometer. So a cephologist is somebody who analyzes the data coming in for the political parties. And so what I had then was I had a yellow ball, a blue ball, and a green ball. Or was it green? It may have been SDP at the time, or no, Liberal Democrats. So I had a Labour one, a Conservative one, and a Liberal Democrat one, as it were, at the time. And I knew a few patterns, and I could do invisible strings. So I could say, oh, they're neck and neck, and, you know, all this. And, oh, no, look, they're all just going round. It's a crazy mess, you know. So I could kind of, you know, make up a little script with that. I wasn't developing a plan, or, you know, it was just the tricks I could do and I could find a way of doing them. That was kind of what it was really at the time.
Yeah. I mean, that sounds quite funny what you did there. I mean, that's sort of like almost comedy juggling there, isn't it?
Yeah, it was. It was definitely meant to be a comic piece. And it was quite funny. I was quite proud of it, really, because I hadn't seen anybody do that before. So it was like it was a context kind of thing. It had a context. And I quite like that, just obviously being theatrical. But I was also with a group of three other guys, so the three of us. So I wasn't performing solo at the time. Everything I did up until nearly 90. So I was juggling for 4 years probably before I ever did a show on my own. Mm-hmm. I was always a double act. I would always, or in this case, a trio.
Yeah.
And we had very, very limited skills, but we were quite strong performers because we were studying theatre. So we were loud, we were kind of, you know, we would test the audience. Is this the right kind of audience for us? Check their pockets, check their cheers, you know, all that. So we had all that down kind of thing. I mean, did very basic acrobatics, very basic juggling, a little bit of Diablo, I think, and mainly Blag. It hasn't changed that much. in a way.
Yeah. So how would you develop a routine, you know, starting from then all the way up to now? Has that changed over the years?
It has, I suppose, but it's very unselfconscious in a way. I develop things as I'm going along. And like a lot of jugglers in the day, it seemed to me the best way to present it was to just tell people what you were doing, you know, just explain it as you're going along. So I don't really have any artful juggling. I mean, I've got a routine that I do with three balls and four balls, which is to music. And that's pretty much the same every time, but it never is exactly the same because I haven't set it to music. It's like, here's the music on, here I'm doing the routine. I generally do the same kind of sequence of things through it. But I still like to keep it loose even now. I don't like to fix things because I realize that the performance is far more important than the tricks, you know. So I like tricks, and I try to pick tricks that are relatable. You know, the two best tricks that there are in juggling as far as performing is concerned for me to this day, as exactly the same ones as they were in 1980 something, which is the invisible string trick and the on the top of the head trick.
Yeah, for sure.
They're the two best tricks, you know, and I've not seen anything in all the time I've been juggling to change my mind about that. There's loads of cool tricks, but good for jugglers to see. But as far as punters are concerned, you can't tell the difference between a Mills mess and a Boston mess and a, you know, whatever.
Yeah, no, I agree. One thing you did say, you said when you're doing a sort of like routine, you're actually telling the audience, oh, I'm throwing, like you're doing tennis. Oh, this one's going over the top. Is that what you're saying?
More or less. I mean, yeah. I've got a routine where what I've got it down, I used to just talk it through. I used to say, oh, there's lots of different tricks you could do. Here's one, here's another. Now I've got a little box of cards in it with the names of tricks written on, and I go out into the audience, I hand them out, and then I say, okay, put your hands up if you've got a card. Okay, what's written on your card? Shout it out so we can all hear what it is. And they say the box, and I go the box. And what I realized was I was doing a 3 or 4 minute juggling routine, and at the end of it, there'd be a smattering of applause for what was essentially 20 years of graft kind of thing, you know. And I used to think, whereas if I do this routine, say, for example, I say to people, this is Cascade, this is the first trick that everybody learns now. But now, if you were to film me doing this and I were to run it backwards, it would look like this. And if you run this backwards and put it this way, then, you know, that would be the Cascade. So, and then I do some finish, you know, like a snappy ending all the time. And I get a round of applause. So I get a round of applause for every trick. And I do between 6 and 12. I sometimes take 9 cards, sometimes, depending on what I think the audience is like, I maybe only do 4, you know, and then I say, oh, we've done that, and then I do the routine. So each has, like, comedy attached to it. It's got a joke, it's got a facial stuff, you know. So I always try to include the invisible string. I usually include gorilla juggling, you know, and I say, oh, no, I thought I hadn't put that one in. It's so embarrassing. I can't believe I'm doing this. And, you know, then do this one. And everyone's like, ha, ha, ha. And I go, please don't clap that. You know what I mean? So it's like, it's all structured with little jokes and comments and stuff like that. So it's not bland. It's spicy.
Is that improv, or is it just something that you've sort of like built up over the years in terms of your banter?
It came from improv. But I mean, I know what I'm doing. And I've got specific gags for different things, you know. So I think I've always found that way of creating a routine, you know, something that I'm interested in showing it or explaining it, and I'll just try and find the best way to do it. I'm working on a routine at the moment where I'm juggling a ball, a club and a ring. So, and I've just started balancing them on a little stand. It's like a thing a table goes on. I put the ball down, I've got a cup head club, I put that on the top of it so it stands in it. Then I put the ring on top, and I might actually do that in the show, like actually place them out. If not, they're already there. And my plan is, and I haven't done it, and I'm going to be doing it for the first time this week. My plan is to say, before I do my show, I'm going to introduce you to the cast of characters. Here we have the juggling ring. You know, the good thing about it, it's all handle. That's the joke for that one. This, on the other hand, has a handle. It's the club. You can spin it this way. You can spin it that. And the ball, we all know a ball. Yeah, everyone's had a go with the ball, they've thrown it, you know, you all know what, maybe you throw it out to the audience and get it back. And then so most of the time you see people juggling 3 clubs, 3 balls or 3 rings, but you very seldom get to see somebody do all 3. And that's because it's incredibly difficult, you know, which is my ruse. Then I balance them. So the club, the ball, and then the ring. And then I take the ring off and I say, I probably won't be speaking during this part of the routine because I'm concentrating. I'm concentrating on the ring. You can concentrate on the ring as well if you like and see what happens. So then I take the ring off, get the ball and the thing going, do the juggling, put the ring on the thing, throw the ball extra high and catch it in the cup of the club. So even though none of that's necessarily true about how difficult it is, whatever, I'm presenting it so that it's a way of looking at it and it's, you know, you can concentrate on something. So I'm hoping that would be quite entertaining. I've got no idea at the moment. We'll see. I'll let you know afterwards.
Yeah, no, that's interesting. So, I mean, I've always listened to how comedians write their jokes, I don't know, in at night or whenever they do it, and then they try and test it out. And I think they said that sometimes you've really got to test it out a few times before you know what clicks and what not clicks. 100%.
Yeah, you've got no idea whether something's going to work. You can do something once and it could be fantastic, and you can do it again and again and again, it just doesn't work. Yeah. And I'll give you an example of that in a minute. Or you can do something you don't think that's anything great about it, but it somehow works, you know, and it just does. So you can't always tell. And I had a joke a long time ago, which was with a Diablo. And I used to throw Diablo high and get everybody going, wow, you know, when you throw it up in the air to get more people to come and watch the show and all that. And it was a warm afternoon. I was doing it and there was a particularly lackluster crowd, you know, so I was doing it and they were kind of going, oh, you know. So I stopped and said, I think this is a good time in the show to explain my philosophy to you folks, is that I believe that, you know, life is made up of a series of moments. And we can choose to make each and every one of those moments something worthwhile and fun and engaging, or we can choose to make it English. It's entirely up to you. And it got a huge laugh, and the show picked up after that point, and people were much more into it and everything like that. And I tried exactly the same thing several times again, and nobody laughed at all. It just sounded like I was being rude, and it was sour grapes. Yes. So in the end, I took it out. But it was a great line at the time, you know. So sometimes it's delivery, sometimes it's the audience, you know, and nothing will work every time. Mm-hmm. So I think you've just got to, for me, you've just got to have enough things, that variety, so that, oh, if this doesn't work, that'll be good. Or if this one's not going down so brilliant, I've got this one in the bag kind of thing, you know. Yeah. That's the way I look at it.
Do you think comedy juggling is kind of a dying art, or do you think people are coming through... are doing that?
Well, I think it's a very good question. I think there's all sorts of things playing into it. Yes, I think it is in one way. I think there are less people doing it. And I think in some ways it's kind of, you know, it's old fashioned, but I think that's part of what I like about it as well. And it fits into a sort of a tradition for me. So I like that. But I think juggling is much more open to other possibilities now that it never was before, which I think is a good thing. So maybe it's making, but I hope that there will always be comedy juggling, you know, because I think it's a good way of presenting juggling. I think it's approachable, and I think it's, you know, in the right context, it's great. But I think it's a fair point that there may be not so many people doing it now. There's a lot more people doing shorter skills acts. If you're doing comedy juggling, the likelihood is you're going to have to do 45 minutes at the very least, an hour. 45 minutes is half an hour, I mean, and maybe even sometimes an hour. It's a hell of a long time. I mean, 45 minutes is too long for any one person, you know, even with a full orchestra. You know what I mean? It's very difficult. It's half the length of a feature film.
Yeah.
And you're only one person and you don't have any explosions or, you know what I mean? So so it is a job of you having to convince people they're going to come with you on whatever you're doing.
Yeah, I'll tell you what, on that, in terms of, you know, 45 minute show and half an hour shows and stuff like that, I mean, that is a long time for a lot of jugglers. I just want to go now to the present day in terms of Instagram and TikTok and all these. Now, I know that, I mean, I put stuff on Instagram and I know you do as well. And there is this thing where you practice and practice and practice just to get that one take. And then you post it on Instagram. Sometimes I actually put the failures on there as well, just to show people that it's hard. You know, how do you feel about that in terms of, because put this way, juggling is huge. Well, okay, it's a lot bigger than it was before. Don't you agree?
Yes and no, but I think in different ways, if you like, because in the 90s it was big. There was a juggling shop in Birmingham, there was a juggling shop in Bristol, there was a juggling shop in Southampton, there was a juggling shop in Newcastle, there was a juggling shop in Gloucester. There was, you know what I mean? There were so it was big in a different way. I think there were a lot more people doing it. I think there's the same number of people doing it. I think the standard is much higher. But I don't know whether there is as many people doing it as there were in, say, 1995, for example. I've got no idea. Possibly. But we don't know that because we've got nothing to compare it to in, with regards to the internet and stuff. So, but it's an interesting thing about posting stuff up, because I'm not somebody, I'll generally get a pattern so I can do it for a few rounds and do it. I never post up anything I can just get and I do, you know, it's either... And I do post up mistakes I haven't done for a while, but it's something I do occasionally. But I post up a massive amount. And I think it's partly because I've just got a lot of stuff. And also I just want to remember things, you know. So quite often I forget what it is that I've done. So I'll put it up there. And then, you know, a year later I'll look again and go, I've completely forgotten about that. And then just carry on.
You're exactly like me. That's how I started putting stuff on Instagram, because I thought, oh yeah, I know how to do this trick, and I'll post it. And then, like you say, years later, I goes, wow, did I know how to do this trick? And so I'll put it up there as almost like a library of my sort of like progress, almost.
And I kind of care about it, and I don't care about it. You know, I care about it in as much as I think all the things that I put up there and try and do, they've got value because I've taken the time to go, oh, I'm going to record this. But then again, I record a lot. I mean, I'll probably do 10 videos a day and post one or two, maybe, you know. And sometimes it's a repetition, something I already do. I try often to have a point. You know, I try often to say something with it, because I like the idea that there's a conversation going on, even though I realise that a lot of the time I'm talking to myself, you know, but I'm okay with that.
Now, as I said, I think, I don't know, for me personally, I think there are more people juggling, only for the fact that you probably can see them more. But one thing you did say, that you're correct, the technical skill now has got to be better than it was. I mean, we spoke and we said that Mills Mess was like the sort of like intermediate trick. We said, but now it's almost the begin, not a beginner trick, but it's beginner going on to intermediate.
Unquestionably, it's changed. And there's all sorts of very obvious reasons for that. And then some not so obvious reasons for that. Obviously, it's completely connected with the internet, but it's also just the fact that people who are coming in at sort of base level, wherever you say that is, they can do three balls for 100 throws or something like that. Whenever they go to a place where there are other jugglers, they're more likely to see somebody who can do seven balls. Years ago, there wasn't anyone, you know, so it was as simple as that. So you're more likely to go, oh, right, that's what's next, you know, whereas you wouldn't have done years ago. It was like, you know, they're doing seven balls or they're doing six clubs or whatever it was, you know. And I can remember in 1988, I saw... I can't remember her name now, great American juggler, female juggler, Cindy Marvell. She did five clubs in a gym in 1988 at the Bradford European Juggling Convention, and the whole place came to a standstill. And it was only like 50 throws or something, you know, but it was the whole gym just stopped. Everybody watched, and then there was a round of applause when the run came to an end, you know. And now you see that as a regular kind of thing, even in just a random club you might turn up to, not necessarily the BJC. So it's definitely different from that point of view.
And I think as well, is if someone says, you know, back in the day, you see one person doing five clubs, you think, oh, I don't know. But when you see it, then you start to believe it. Then you know that if she or that person can do it, then you can do it. And I think that's the thing, that you're seeing more highly skilled juggling patterns and juggling routines now, or tricks now. You think, oh, okay, I didn't think that was possible, but it is possible, and it makes you think that you can do it as well.
Well, I think it's like the Roger Bannister effect. Yeah. You know, when before he'd run the 4-minute mile, everyone's saying, oh, your head will fall off or whatever, you know, if you do that, or you'll have a heart attack. And then I think within 6 months of him doing it, there was like 13 people who'd done it. And then within a year, there was like 60 people, you know, it was unbelievable. And I think it's very much the same thing. There's a glass ceiling, or the ceiling is much, much higher now than it was before, you know. So people doing monster throws and lots of stuff underneath it, you know, that was, And the understanding of SiteSwap has also pushed that momentum, because you can do so many more things than just the standard hold it there kind of pattern, you know, which was how it used to be.
No, for sure. So in terms of performances, what's the sort of like one of the performances sort of like stands out for you that you can think of over the years that
the truth is that if performances go well, then there's very little to say about them, you know. How did it go? Oh, it was great. You know, it's not much of a headline. So the things that you tend to remember are the disasters or the things that go wrong. And I think that one that sticks in my mind, and it's not really a juggling incident, but I suppose it was fire. I was doing fire juggling as I did. I haven't done it for about 5 or 10 years now, but I used to do it a lot. And I used to do I had a fire routine with 3 clubs and 4 clubs. And I would do head spins and with fire torches and all that kind of stuff. And and I used to have this thing about when the flames were going down, I used to have a little pot with more fuel in it. And I used to say, you know, blow that. I'm building up to my final trick now, but we've got to have bigger flames because more flames means more danger. More danger means more applause, and more applause means more. That's right. More money in the hat at the end. You guessed it. You know, all that sort of stuff. So I remember always blow them out before you put them in. So I dipped it and then relit it and then dipped it. And the last one, I thought it was, again, a hot day. It was August. It was very hot. So it was very bright as well. So it wasn't easy to see. It's quite difficult to see flames in really bright light. Blew out the last one, put it in, but it hadn't blown out completely. So I put it in my hand like that. And it was fine. It was just a little, you know, cat food tin with a little flame coming out of it. And I set forward to do the next bit. And I was just shaking the torches. And somebody said, oh, your tin's on fire. Your tin's on fire. So I went, don't worry, that's no problem for a professional like me. And I picked it up and I just blew into it. I didn't even think. And it was just this huge fireball, you know, like just went straight into my face.
Oh.
Kind of stood up shocked like this. Big cheer.
Oh.
Absolutely ridiculous. I could smell my nose hair had gone, my eyebrows were singed, my ear hair was singed, you know, and my face was stinging. And I was fine, but it was, you know, it was just like, what an idiot. So that was probably the most memorable thing. And to make matters worse, my ex had come along to watch my shows that day as well. And she saw me do this idiotic thing, burn my face off for entertainment.
Oh, God. I could imagine. Yeah, that's probably the most memorable one. Yeah, you're right. I mean, the ones that sort of like go well, you're not going to remember them.
I mean, another one in the same venue, a slightly different place in the same venue. I can remember it was near Christmas and I was getting towards the end of a show and I was juggling knives this time. And I happened to notice out the corner of my eye, this child running up this way. And they hadn't even noticed there was a show going on, I don't think. And they ran sort of into the audience, and the audience got out of the way because they could hear the child or see the child. And this child ran straight across to their mother, who was standing on my right-hand side. And I literally had to pull the knives out of the way of the path of this child, you know. And, okay, they're not sharp, but you know what I mean? You don't want to keep
hit by
a piece of metal. So I did that, like, and then all eyes went to where the child was, and then this woman hit the child. For being so stupid, you know, and I couldn't collect any money for the show, because in that moment everything had just been taken away. Everyone kind of went like this. I was just coming to the end of the show, and I said, "Well, thanks very much for watching. I think I'm just going to go and sit down."
Yeah. Wow. You know,
nothing I could do. But that was a lesson in how, if you don't deal with something like that, and I didn't see how I could deal with it in that moment. Everything you built can just go just like that.
Okay. I'll tell you what, well, let's talk about the BJC, because that was my first sort of like proper convention that been to, because I went to the one, there was one in London, it was called the London Symposium. I don't know if you remembered that one.
That
was about 5 or 6 years ago, and that was the first one I went to, and that was sold out within, because there's not many juggling conventions actually in London. They all seem to be which is surprising, really. But anyway, and so the BJC for me was my first one. I mean, I can tell that you've been to quite a few of them. I mean, what do you think the sort of like the plus points and the value of these conventions are?
Oh, they're invaluable to me. I mean, I think I've been to 25 BJCs, and I went to one in Bristol every year until the pandemic. I mean, it was 33 years. I went every single year. It was a 10-day festival in Bristol, camping and stuff. And when it first started, there were 30 of us. Then it built up to about 300, and then it kind of leveled out somewhere around 100, maybe. People go regularly. I just think, from the point of view of being in amongst, I mean, somebody said about the convention at the BJC, they said, oh, it's like you walk in the door and you just go, oh, they get me, you know. And it's that. People just understand a lot of people doing something completely pointless just for the joy of it, just for the kick of it, just for the learning of it, just for the whatever they get from it. And in fact, that was an introduction at an IJA years ago, a guy called Bill Goodis. I think he might have been producing the Juggling magazine in America years ago or something. And it's right at the beginning of this IJA VHS video I used to have. And this guy said, well, here it is, the IJA, the largest collection of jugglers in the world, the largest collection of people doing juggling from and enjoying it for whatever they enjoy it for. And I thought, that's a brilliant way of describing juggling, because, you know, it is different things people get from it, but it's the same thing, you know, and it's this, it's the same joy of doing something new, discovering something, you know. And every convention has its own flavor, you know, and every convention has its own ups and downs or whatever, you know. So, but I mean, I've never been to a convention I haven't enjoyed.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah, no, you're right. When you say you go into the room and people get you, for me, that's the, as soon as I got in there, I just saw, even at the beginning, as you come into the auditorium, not the auditorium, as you're coming into where you buy your ticket, I think they had volunteers that were security and they were juggling. Yeah. So you knew that they were volunteering. You think, hold on, the security's juggling. So you know that, you know, they're part of, you know, the whole convention, and they volunteered to help out.
A world of juggling. And funnily enough, I was doing a show in a holiday camp in Cornwall some years ago now, and there's a guy came up to me. I don't know whether you knew, but there was a BJC in Cornwall some years ago. And this big burly guy came up to me and said, you know, you ever heard of the juggling convention? I said, yeah, well, I've been to most of them. Ironically, I didn't go to the one in Cornwall, despite the fact I live in Devon. Uh-huh. And he said, oh, it was brilliant, that. He said, I've never enjoyed doing security at an event so much. Everyone was nice. Everyone was polite. Everyone was clean. Everyone was, you know. He said, okay, they have funny colour hair and stuff like that, but they were great, you know. And I just thought, that's it. You know, jugglers tend to be pretty open, generally pretty respectful, and generally, you know, quite kind about how they go about their business. Very generous with teaching people things, you know, and it's a great community from that point of view.
No, you're right. I mean, you know, I haven't done juggling, so I haven't done passing for, well, since before lockdown, because I just haven't had anyone, you know, to pass.
Yeah.
And I found loads of people that I could pass. I mean, my passing wasn't as great, but they had the patience, you know, to sit there, you know, to stand there and, you know, go through the patterns it's and fun, stuff like
fun,
that.
You know, it's fun juggling with somebody who's never done it before. It's fun.
Yeah, it is.
Doing somebody's first passing, which, I mean, I used to love it. I used to love passing with people who hardly done any, you know, trying to catch their stuff and trying to put it back exactly the right place to make it easy. It's great fun, you know.
Yeah, it is. And everyone's just so welcoming, so forgiving, giving their time, happy to teach. I didn't find anyone that, you know, that was, yeah, they didn't want to do that. No, it was great. And that's what I liked about the convention.
Yeah.
And just the workshops. I mean, I tried everything. I mean, I went back to back to back. I think it was one day that I didn't even have lunch because I just wanted to cram things in, because you just know that this sort of like event is not going to come around every, well, for me, it'd be once a year. I mean, there's probably other conventions that I could go to, but I knew I had to make the most of it. And I tried something new everywhere.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, I think workshops are a much bigger thing than they used to be. They were sort of a bit of an offshoot years ago. It's like, oh, maybe, oh, somebody's running a workshop, oh, I probably won't go, I'm getting wasted in the gym or whatever, you know. So I think there's much more intent now than there used to be. And the Play Festival as well has driven that on. You know, there's other festivals which are sort of devoted in a sense to learning. And there's another interesting thing. I think that the amount of knowledge that is held within that cradle now is vastly greater than it was years ago. So it was just a few people knew some stuff and they'd share it. Whereas now there's lots of niche areas, people doing, I don't know, I'm gonna do a workshop on scissor catches with clubs, or I'm gonna do a workshop, you know, it's specific and it's particular and it's all that. So it's, yeah, it's interesting from that point of view.
No, you're right. I mean, yeah, just on that, there was one guy that did just multiplex throws, an hour just on that. And you think, what is there to know? But then I went to the workshop and you think, hold on, he's only given us a small part of what he knows.
Yeah, well, strangely enough, that used to be my thing. But I mean, I remember when I ran the convention in Exeter in 1990, I did two workshops because I just wanted to get away from the desk and stuff like that. And one of the workshops I did was about multiplexing. I was really, really into it a few years ago, not so much now. So I got a lot to say about multiplexing.
Yeah, no, I just say there's a lot. I mean, juggling is a niche sport. I'm going to call it a sport or a pastime or a hobby, but within juggling there's a lot of niche areas. I mean, like, I went to your table juggling session,
yeah,
and that gave me so many ideas, because there's a couple of workshops that I want to do with people that just can't stand for a long time. In fact, explain the sort of like how you arrived at the table juggling, because I just think that's such an interesting story.
Yeah, well, the table juggling is, yeah, it is interesting in that I was quite ill, seriously ill. I had a chronic asthma attack, funnily enough, after the EJC 2019 in Newark, and it was because it was in Newark, which is a place, it's a horse racing place, and horse might, there was a big hall we were in a lot of the day. And because it was very windy there, we couldn't use the big top. So we were in the hours every day instead of a few hours. We were there for 10 hours a day or something. And obviously I got this horse mite into my system. And I ended up in intensive care for 24 hours after coming back from the convention. It was nuts. But when I was in recovery, I was wired up for a few days, so I couldn't do anything really, just lying about in bed. But as soon as I was able to move my hands or they unplugged things, I was like, oh, what am I going to do? You know, got to have something with my hands to do. So my partner brought in three tiny little pink bean bags, and I used to sit in there like a window sill kind of thing, and I'd roll them and bounce them so they come back. It was pathetic. It's tragic, really. And I also found a chair which had a molded back, and I could kind of roll them down this chair, and that was good fun. And when I got back, I found I wanted to do some, I was looking forward to getting back to do some juggling. I was standing up. I couldn't do more than a minute or two standing up. It was just exhausting. So we just so happened to have bought a coffee table around that time, which is a glass one. So it's a really, really smooth surface. And I had some orange stage balls, and I would just, you know, mess about, just kind of rolling them along like this, and three of them. And then I was, okay, that can't be it. There must be more than that. Then I realized, oh, I could roll them in like a reverse cascade. Oh, I could move them from the edges of the table. I could bring them directly towards me just using this rolling, getting the timing right. Then I realized there was other tricks I could do with the rolling. And then after a while, I started to realize this could be an application for the bouncing stuff that I do. So I got a hard surface, and I did all the stuff with the table juggling with bouncing. Then I started mixing up bouncing and rolling and ordinary juggling. So you've got all three different types of juggling going on at the same time. Then I realized there was a whole lot of stuff you could demonstrate with beanbags. You know, so it was like learning a new area, but it was as big as ordinary juggling itself is, because you've got a surface. You're taking away gravity. You've got time. You've suddenly got two balls in your hands. You know, one's on the floor. You've suddenly got, you know, more time to do something. And it blew me away, you know, and that kept me going. I mean, I've 2 or 3 years and I'm still finding stuff now. And I've got a lot of time for it. And I think I explained at that session, I've also realized you can use the table as a kind of a respite from gravity, you know. Yeah. To that time when you're throwing it up in the air, you've got to do something with the other two. You can drop it down, just do that thing in your own time, then pick it up and carry on. That's massive for me. I've learned tricks, there's several tricks, as a result of being able to do that kind of analysis.
Yeah, I mean, that's one thing that I do offer advice to people when they start to learn to juggle, is to juggle over a bed or a table.
Absolutely.
Also a bed, because, you know, they're going to drop. I mean, let's face it, all of us don't know about how long we've been juggling for.
Yeah.
We're still good. So juggling over a bed is always good, because then, you know, you just have to pick up and just carry on again. I just think, I'm just amazed by us jugglers in terms of our creativity. Do you think that's something that is that's developed, or do you think that's something that is, you know, that we've always had within us?
I think it's possibly relatively innate for somebody who chooses to do juggling. because there's a certain amount of risk involved in juggling. There's a certain kind of, you may look foolish, you may feel foolish, you may. So there's a playfulness to juggling, which you don't get, I think, learning other skills sometimes, where you have to be prepared to fail and you have to be prepared for things to go wrong. And for each stage you get, that's the same. So you keep on, you learn the same thing over and over again, that actually a bit of humility in the face of gravity or whatever. But so I think that playful element means that it does tend to attract creative people. That said, I also realized after a good number of years juggling that a huge number of juggling people are complete nerds, and they're scientists, they're computer programmers, they're mathematicians, they're people who deal with logic and pattern and, you know, all that. Another area of jugglers, there's a lot of very, very good jugglers who are musicians as well, which makes complete sense, because if you learn music when you're young, you'll be used to the idea of breaking something down into manageable chunks, going, repeating something over and over again till it's smooth, et cetera, et cetera. So there are crossover things, but I do think there's an element of openness within juggling because of that playful and being prepared to risk and fail, you know, and not worry about it too much.
Yeah, and I think because when I've taught workshops, and you can sense the people that don't want to drop. They want to look good in front of, I don't know, their partner or their children or whatever. Whereas the children don't care; they'll just drop. I'm not saying that's all adults, but if you can just sort of like put that aside, that humility aside, and just know that you're going to drop, and yeah, you're going to feel foolish and stuff like that. And I think, I don't know, it goes a long way.
I mean, creativity is about risk.
Yes.
You know, creativity is about seeing if something will work or won't work, or, you know, and it doesn't matter too much whether it does or it doesn't. You found something out, you know, and I think that's quite scientific as well. So it has that, oh, let's do an experiment here. Let's, you know, so I can see why people are attracted to it from that point of view. Or let's see if it works. Let's see if we, you know, and for me, the question is, what if? What if you did this? What if you did it with your hands here? What if you did it with your hands over here? What if you did it trying to look away? What if you did it, you know, to constantly ask those questions. But I mean, creativity in a way is my, along with comedy and with juggling and performing, creativity, I think, is the most important element of all of this for me. And also in the last 2 or 3 years, over lockdown and everything, I've thought about it more and more, is actually thinking is more critical to me now than it ever was with juggling and all my other activities, to be honest. The way in which you think about something will determine the way in which you do it. Yeah. So, and also I think if you want to go into a creative space, and particularly a juggling one, I also think now, and it doesn't need hours of warming up, it doesn't necessarily need that, but I think you can put yourself, there's whatever frame of mind you're going into your juggling in with, you could probably make a slightly better one with a bit of care about how you entered into it.
Yeah.
The contract with yourself, if you like, yeah. You know. And for some people that may mean setting goals and, you know, saying, okay, I'm going to do 50 of this and 50 of this or whatever it may. For other people, it may just be, I'm putting music on and I'm just trying to allow myself to go wherever it goes. You know, it's different for different people. For me, I try and do something different every day, something I've never done before. And at the very least, I try and improve the things that I was already, you know, getting to grips with. Yeah. Those are my two things in practice.
Yeah, no, you're similar to me. Let's talk about your book, because I know you were plugging your book at the BJC. So
plug it again.
So, I mean, you spoke a little bit about what you, you know, in terms of practice and the creativity and stuff like that. Just explain what the book is about.
The book is kind of partly about that. I mean, so it's what it's not is a how-to book. This is a how-to book by Tom Wall. And this explains tricks, takes it apart. How does SiteSwap work? How does this work? What's this trick? What's that trick? This book is more of a sort of experiential look at juggling. What does it feel like? Why are you attracted to it? Why do you do it? If you practice it alone, have you discovered a way that's good for you for practicing? So it's asking the question constantly about how does whatever else you do relate to practice? So how does music relate to practice? How does, if you're a performer, how does that relate to your practice? If you're somebody who is a sports juggler? How is your practice different for somebody who's just does it for fun? You know, all sorts of different routes to it. It's not one thing. And I think more than anything else, that's what I learned also writing the book, is I suppose that I had thought that, oh, everybody thinks more or less the same way about juggling. Oh, people go into it the same sort of reasons. Maybe there's a certain amount of that. But I also realized once I started talking to people, that wasn't the case at all. People came into it for very different reasons. People get different things out of it, even though it's the same thing. But I was trying to relate. So all the chapters in the book.
What's the name of the book?
Yeah, the name of the book is Juggling and the Art of Practice. So there's a chapter on creativity and practice. There's a chapter on play and practice. There's a chapter on progress and practice. There's a chapter on persistence and practice. So I broke it down into all these. So when I had all these quotes stuck all over my wall, I probably had 100 quotes, and I knew I would never get 100 quotes in, so probably reduced to about 50, maybe 60 quotes. So then I was thinking, okay, what things do I want to talk about with regard to practice? So progress is one thing, for example. What's your attitude to progress? Do you set goals, or do you just go wherever it will take you? Or are you interested in this? Or so it's lots of questions about the different ways in which you can practice. I think sometimes people think of, oh, you just do this, but it's not. There's a myriad of different approaches you could take. And so it's exploring a number of those and then offering people, you know, the chance to kind of decide what kind of practice they want for them, you know.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. Okay. And are you doing another book? Because I heard you said that you were going to be doing another book. Because it must take a long time to write these books.
I'm not sure. I'm looking at a thing now, a little project at the moment, which I'm calling the Alphabet of Creativity. Mm-hmm. And it's just it's a series of words, really. Are just words that obviously follow the alphabet, and it's words that you could take into a creative space, whether it's music, whether it's theatre, whether it's juggling, whether it's whatever, and the way in which we relate to the words. So it's it's like, I think I mentioned, did I mention Brian Eno to you when we were talking? He says, do you know who I mean by Brian Eno?
No, I don't know.
Brian Eno is a record producer. He used to work for Roxy Music, and he was the synth guy in Roxy Music. And since then, he's produced David Bowie, Talking Heads, Coldplay, U2, you know, any note, Devo, lots and lots of bands. And he's got a very unique approach to how he works with people. But in 1975, him and another guy called Peter Schmidt, who's a painter, they wrote 100 cards with sort of cryptic or gnomic pronouncements on them called Oblique Strategies. And it's a fantastic thing. And basically, if you're a creative in any form and you come across a block, you go to the cards and you pick out an oblique strategy. And it might say something like, honor thy mistake as a hidden intention. That's a famous one. And I made ones up saying things like, you know, make it more blue, or have you tried it higher? Or, you know, so there's sort of no, you know, they're funny sort of things. So I wrote a whole load of those for circus performers as well, which would apply to trapeze or acrobatics, or, you know, phrases that you could throw into the mix of what you were doing. So if you come across a block, you can kind of open it up by just following this card for a while. You don't have to make a decision. Somebody else will make it for you.
Yeah.
And so I think random kind of interventions are brilliant in creative work and learning work. So you change the program. I'm going, not getting anywhere. Change it. You know, go somewhere else then. Go in a different direction. Don't get stuck, you know. So that's very much how I try to approach things as well. Changing it up a bit.
Yeah, got it. Now, you're right, because in terms of just juggling, you can transfer these skills to others, and you can bring other skills into juggling, you know, especially sort of like the learning aspect as well. So that's one thing that I've found.
Well, I've been thinking about that more and more. I think particularly now, as I get to the point where, you know, if you told me 5 years ago that a time would come where I wasn't that so interested in performing, I would have gone away with you, you know. But actually, and it's not so much the performing itself, which I still really enjoy, but it's all the rest of it, you know, the travel, getting loaded up and all that kind of stuff, and then like worrying about it or whatever if you haven't done it for a bit, those things, they're a pain in the ass, and I can live without them. So I'm heading myself more towards mentoring, teaching, writing about it, talking about it. And I realized recently, I've reached out to another community just very recently of creative people to do with Ken Robinson. I've joined the Ken Robinson Foundation kind of thing.
Oh, yeah, the one that did the YouTube video, the one that went viral.
New Schools Kill Creativity.
That's it, yes.
A lot of time for that, and I've read his books and stuff. And there's a foundation which you can kind of get linked up to, which is full of creative people. I've just joined that because I realised that a lot of the time I just talk to the juggling community. And actually, a lot of the ideas I have, I think they're not going to go anywhere in the juggling community. Like, I want to be seen doing what I do or explaining what I do or talking about, and somebody to go, you're just the guy we need to work with these patients with motor neuron or whatever it may be. Mm-hmm. And I'm not going to find that within the juggling community. I mean, I might do, but I need to go outside of it. And also to show other people the applications that there are with juggling and its connections with creativity, learning, openness, vulnerability, improvisation, all of these things. And I want people to see, but the trouble is, I think juggling is sometimes a label or it's a word where people go, oh, I know what that is. And that's it. You know, that's what they've got in their head, that. And that's not even the tip of the iceberg. That's like a snowflake on the tip of the iceberg. You know, it's so enormous and its applications are so profound for, you know, cross-lateral thinking, for coordination, confidence. I mean, more than anything else, having taught thousands of workshops over the years, that thing, it's, you know, like give a man a fishing rod, you know, all that stuff. It's the same thing with juggling. Give somebody the belief or give somebody an opportunity to learn something they can do and then they can repeat. That is confidence. It literally is the embodiment of confidence, saying, I've got a plate, I've got a stick, I know I'm going to be able to make it spin. I can throw it in the air and catch it again.
Yeah.
That's a massive thing for so many people, just that simple act. And I say simple, I was terrible at plate spinning, but, you know, I found it incredibly frustrating, but it's enormously empowering. And I mean, I used to hate teaching plate spinning at workshops. I absolutely love it now. And it's one of the biggest kicks I get is seeing somebody get it going or maybe throwing, catching it. And it's exactly the same excitement, whether they're 6 or 66, you know, and that's really, and the same as watching somebody get 10 cycles of a cascade. It's unbelievable. And it may never be as good again.
No, I agree. To see people actually getting it right. It's like when I always started to teach a Rubik's Cube, and that time when they actually finish it, it never leaves me. Just the enjoyment that I see on their face and the pleasure that I get, it never leaves me. Same with the juggling.
Yeah.
And
it's people amazing themselves.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's a very, I used to think that was quite sort of pat, really, but it's not. I think it's profound. You know, I think it's not, you're not being given it. You're not being told it. You're not absorbing it. You're doing it. You're making it happen in time and space. Yeah. And it's making your brain go, wow, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's an amazing thing.
What advice would you give to someone regarding sort of like starting juggling?
That's quite difficult, I think, in some ways, because on the one hand, I want to say, take it slow and go through it step by step and make a really good foundation. And, you know, that will help you a lot and it'll be less frustrating. On the other hand, the way I teach is bombarding people with stuff to do, because I think you can kind of pick and choose. So I think the way in which I present it to people is contrary to what I might say. But I don't think they're necessarily mutually exclusive. So I think you can, I do think it's worthwhile having good foundations, but it's not the be all and end all. And I think, you know, like I've now started teaching clubs quite differently to how I would have done 15, 20 years ago. Quite recently, I've just been thinking about, you know, the spin, getting a spin, like, and I mean like a wrist to spin, forget your arm. It's not that. It's all in the spin. It's not in the throw. The throw is just a little thing that comes on the end to guide the spin, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So So my philosophical approach to it is different to how it used to be. On the other hand, I also personally look at clubs differently now myself because of people rolling them all over their bodies and stuff like that. I say, well, I can't look at it as just something, a stick with a handle anymore, because that's not what it is. It was, but it is now. It's a different animal, and it's because people have changed its application. It hasn't changed. The club's the same as it was, but people have found a way to move with it and think about it in ways that would have been impossible some years ago.
Yeah.
And funnily enough, I saw one of my heroes at the IJA last year. He's called Mark Laffey. I don't know whether you've ever seen him, but I'll send you a link to Taylor's video. And there's a guy, it's very obvious in it. He's wearing a pair of jeans and a blue T-shirt. He's got a beard. He's got gingerish sort of hair. And he rolls. He did all the contact club stuff years before I ever saw anybody do it. And he came out with a video, and it was shot under one of the kind of a remote bridge, kind of out of town sort of thing, one of those kind of videos. And it was mind blowing because it looked like he got the whole thing. It wasn't like he was doing a trick. He could do it. Nobody else was doing it. And he could do it all. Now, whether he'd gone to South America and seen it there, or I don't know. I never found out, but I spoke to him. A lovely time talking. But it's a different type of sensitivity. It's like, here I am throwing the clubs. I'm making it do doubles. I'm making it do triples. I'm making it do back crosses. I'm making it do this. It's almost like the rolling thing is you're allowing it to do this. And in fact, Bernard, the guy who I was hanging out with, who you met me with at the convention, the Brazilian guy, he talked a lot about you send a club in motion, then you're allowing it or you're supporting it. It's a different philosophy. And it's not something I can really get that into. I can sort of touch on the outskirts of it, but it's not something I'm ever going to do.
Yeah,
it's just too long. I can see, oh my God, that's going to take just forever to get that sense that I'm not even going to go there. But I really appreciate the fact that the club is now not the same item as I was talking about 20 years ago.
Yeah, no, definitely. I mean, I love all that contact juggling. And yeah, I mean, the whole juggling scene has sort of kind of merged from flow arts to juggling. I know there was this thing between the jugglers and the flow arts, but I don't know, I'm not sure if there's still that sort of like thing, but for me, yeah, I think it's all merged into one now. For me,
in certain quarters there is, I think there's still some resistance in pockets, but I think it's pretty much been crushed now. And I think the thing is that I love it because I used to like flow stuff before. I did a lot of stick twirling and things like that, which wasn't contact stuff, but it was through the fingers and everything. So I've always enjoyed that twirl. When I'm juggling, I mean, I had a long discussion with Taylor about this. Her favorite bit of juggling is working out the problem. There's this pattern. I've got to work out how can I deconstruct it and make it work for me in my head. My favorite bit is having learned it, and I can feel it. It's really smooth and it's nice. And it's so my pleasure comes at the other end of the equation, really. I get frustrated with working things out and I get bored and all that. Whereas so my pleasure is in the doing, of stuff.
Yeah. Now, I must admit, I like both ends. I like the, really struggling to get the pattern down and everything like that, because I think I just love learning. And then obviously once you get it down, then, there's the pleasure there. Yeah.
You like Rubik cubes, enough said. that's the puzzle thing. I don't like that. I've never got on with Rubik cubes and stuff. It's not I can see why people do it, and I get why other people like it, but it's not in the same way as Kendama. It's just not for me. Watching it, I can enjoy it and stuff like that, but it's not for me. It's a different mentality. But I appreciate it. But I was going to say, going back to what you were talking about, is the merger of everything. Apart from the internet, the biggest single other factor in juggling changing the way it has over the last few years is the hybridizing of the different disciplines. And maybe that's almost had a bigger impact than the internet, and I think it's great. It's just so different, because what I like about it is I think the possibilities for juggling have changed. But I still find there's a problem with the limitation of language, and I'm not quite sure how you get around that. See, manipulation's not a very good word either, because these days it's all, its connotations are complicated and stuff. But I really like, I have a T-shirt with serial manipulator on it, which is about juggling, but I really like it. But I realise that it can appear a bit threatening to some people.
having that on. You know.
So just in terms of, just before we finish up, I just want to know what your philosophy on teaching someone three balls. Do you start off with one ball and then move on? Say in a 45-minute session, do you start off with one ball, then two, then maybe try and get onto three? Or do you just try and make it fun and just get them to improve their coordination and give them that sort of confidence to move on? What's your philosophy on that?
It depends on the ages and the abilities of the people I'm faced with. So I don't do it the same way everywhere I go. I'll certainly spend a bit of time with one, whoever I'm doing it with, just to get the idea of different types of throws and how you can get a swing of your arm, how you can keep your elbows in, that sort of stuff. I do loads of stuff with two. I'm a big aficionado on two, but I do a lot of straight up and down stuff. And I do quite a bit of, you know, just so you're aware of the space, you're aware of the time, you're aware of how much time there is if you throw something up and tap your hand, and then, oh, look, I can do it. You know, I've got different places to do it. So I spend quite a bit of time doing that stuff. And then sometimes I'll do three, but I also think sometimes then people think, oh, that's it, that's juggling. So I'm reluctant to do that. So quite often I'll do a lot of stuff with two with a group, and then I'll do scarves. So when we get to three, we do scarves. Because you've got a bit more time, it's less to do with failing, it's less to do with stress, and it's a bit more waving your arms about and stuff like that. So, yeah, my answer is it's different for different people. But I try to get an idea that juggling is not to do, it doesn't stand alone. It's to do with coordination. It's to do with understanding what you're trying to do. It's to do with forging a path. It's to do with repetition. It's to do with understanding the relationship of where things are. It's to do with how high you throw. It's to do with the throws, not much to do with the catch. You know, all of those things. I try to go through those things while we're doing everything else leading up to the. And then I'll you know, if I do a three thing, I'll get one, two, three, drop, drop, drop. Or I'll do one, two, three, drop, catch, catch. And then one, two, three, catch, catch, catch. Then swap it over the other way. So I'll do all those traditional things as well. But I myself, now I'm moving away from the idea that the cascade is the only way to teach juggling. I mean, I think the reverse cascade has definitely a legitimate claim to be a more logical way of doing something than the cascade. I mean, you're throwing the balls into yourself with the reverse. You're throwing the balls away from yourself with the cascade, you know? So the shower, yeah, I mean, my relationship to the shower changes over time. Sometimes I think it's the best thing since sliced bread. Other times I wish I'd never come across it, you know.
Well, when you say the shower, you're talking about the two-ball shower or the three-ball shower?
No, any ball, five, six,
you know, okay, cool.
Whatever number you want, you know, just the
yeah, you know,
the thing of it. Yeah. But in terms of hand speed, there's no better pattern.
Yeah.
You know, working on hand speed. So I like the shower as a tool. As well as a pattern in its own right. I mean, I think it's a great, you know, and I think sometimes I like to think of things in that way. The pattern becomes a tool or a key to something else rather than, oh, here's just a pattern. Yeah. So I like to think about principles rather than patterns. Even though I love patterns, I like to try and say to people, well, this is a pattern, but underlying the pattern is the under the arm throw, for example, or, you know, moving a hand across like this, you know, so there's always more than one learning process going on at a time.
I like what you said, that I think once you learn the three ball cascade, everyone thinks that's it, so you try not to get there too early, or you try not to get there at all. What's I couldn't understand what you meant by that.
If you say, well, that's juggling, that's it. And it is, but it's also that seemed like, oh, well, that's juggling, I've done it now. That's the end.
Sure. Yeah.
And really, you want to say, well, that's the beginning.
Beginning, yes.
Of something. That's not the end of something. That's the beginning of something else. But I think it's, and I'm the same with, I have the same opinion about symmetry. If you learn a trick one way, then your next thought in your head is, I've got to learn it the other way.
Yeah.
You may have cut off a whole load of other stuff which you might have gone on to do had you not then decided to go and do that. And so I love symmetrical stuff. All people who like juggling like symmetrical stuff, but there's a big place in my heart for asymmetry. And I often think it's more interesting. But yeah But people seem to be obsessed with it. Like if you ever post anything up and you're doing something on one side, they go, oh, can you do it on the other side? Or can you do it every throw? Or can, and it's like, oh, I don't want to.
Yeah.
If I wanted to, that's what I would have posted up. But, and also I try like finding space within patterns. It's just as a good example of this, the 4-2-3 pattern that I learned while I was in lockdown. I think I might have mentioned it to you, but it's my kind of go-to pattern when I'm talking about patterns. This, I don't know, you'll know the one I do if I do.
Yeah.
You see what I'm doing?
Yeah.
But so the logical end to that is this. So everyone, but I prefer to go. Oh, not so many gaps, actually.
Yeah.
One space. Now, if I'm looking at those two patterns, I prefer that one.
Same here.
To the everyone one, because it feels like it's forced or whatever, you know. And so if you've got really fast hands, fine, it may not look like that, but for me, I don't feel the need to always do that anymore. I used to, but I don't now, because it's just like, well, what am I gaining by doing that, you know?
And for me, visually it looks different, whereas I think to the, you know, for someone that doesn't really know juggling, I don't think they will understand. Like, I don't think they can see it when you're doing it synchronously.
No, there's probably not a pattern. I mean, the other thing I didn't say that I probably ought to say is that, and I think I said to you when we were talking, but my juggling that I do for performing and stuff like that is completely unrelated to the juggling I do for myself.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
You know, hopefully everything I do in the show is relatively straightforward and I'm not concentrating on it. I'm concentrating on talking to the audience.
Yeah.
Whereas when I'm juggling at home, I'm pretty much fully concentrated on the juggling. Because that's what I'm doing when I'm doing that, you know.
Ben, thank you very much for coming onto the podcast.
It's a real pleasure. Anytime, Reggie.
No, as I said, and I really want to delve into what we spoke about, because we touched on it when we met, about the space within the within the space juggling pattern. The space within it. I know you said you did a thesis on it, so would you want to come back again and we can do maybe just discuss that?
For sure. I'd be very happy to do that. Yeah.
Brilliant. Thank you very much.
It's my pleasure, my friend. You take care.